Hey everybody, this is James Teensma, and this is episode 5 of The Art of Letting Go. This is part 2 of a conversation I started last episode about my liver transplant, and this episode is going to focus on the amazing person who donated her liver to me so that I had a second and actually third and fourth chance at living life right. So settle in. And let's begin with The Art of Letting Go. So I want to put it out here on the front half of this podcast, before I actually get into my donor story, that when telling it, I can very easily become overwrought with emotion. Of course, that whole concept is why I have a podcast. But in her story particularly, I find that I'm still wondering why it is that I received that gift, that extra opportunity at life, with whom it is I'm supposed to share, and what it is exactly that I'm supposed to accomplish with this. Here's what I know, is that for me to waste a moment of her precious gift is an insult to the whole idea of organ donation. And so I vow not to do that. I vow to tell strictly those parts of her story that show once and for all, at least to me, and I hope to you, that we are not alone. That there is something or someone watching over us. And that those things that could separate us are also the very things that bring us together. Her story is my story. I've become part of her legacy. And to let her down would be a travesty. And I purposely am trying to live my life in a way that honors her gift. I hope she's proud. Let's take a very, very brief moment here and just refresh from the previous episode. So I was contacted directly by IUMED in Indianapolis on July 24th, 2015, that a liver was available should I meet the criteria, and that I needed to come immediately to Indianapolis from where I was in Chicago so that we could begin the pre-testing before they went and procured my donor's liver. July 24th is an obvious important date, and it's clear that being called on July 24th of all days was not an accident. And I think as we continue on with this story, the story of my donor, that we understand exactly how little of a coincidence this truly was. So, as I got to Indianapolis, we were first under the impression, I'll say my parents in particular, thought they had overheard a nurse inadvertently let it slip where my donor liver may come from. This would, of course, be against any policy, so my parents weren't going to say anything publicly, but they did indicate to me where they believed they heard this donor liver was coming from. So it's a narrative that I carried on not only after transplantation immediately, but for several months. You see, when you go down to any place that handles transplantation and you're doing your preliminary training, one of the things that is told you is what's expected from the donor themselves. And in the case of livers, obviously they have to be of the same blood type. I don't mind telling you that my blood type is B positive. That is not only my lifestyle, but it also is a very rare blood type. Roughly 7% of Americans have it. So the chance for me to get a liver as immediately as somebody else was actually not that great. I had to in essence, wait for somebody with B positive blood type, or at least B blood type to be in a situation to donate. I had to receive the full liver and stem system of the liver. I could not receive a partial transplantation. I could not receive a living donor transplantation. With PSC, it attacks the whole mechanism. And so if they were to just replace it with a portion of somebody else's liver, or replace it with a partial liver of some type, that PSC would probably attack it at a greater rate than it attacked the original liver. Because you didn't cut off the ugly head of the beast. You know what I'm saying? You didn't remove the actual disease. So that also compounded the ability to receive a liver in what would be considered a normal time frame. One of the other things that we learned in our training was that my donor would have to be a male. It would have to be a man, because that also was just one of the criteria. Women get women livers, men get men livers. The world is a happy place. And they would have to be roughly the same body size as me. Well, you know, I shared with you in earlier episodes that my senior year in high school, I thought I was tipping the scales at 185. Mercy. I haven't grown since fifth grade, so my 5'9 frame has been the same since then. But my weight at this point, by the time I received my liver, was 240 pounds, some 55 pounds heavier than my heaviest in high school. Now, a lot of that was actually from the liver disease itself. I wasn't able to process or move bile, get some of the impurities out of my system. So they kind of collected, and that made a lot of sense, probably more sense than I would know how to explain, frankly. But I'll just say it made sense, and that way I don't feel guilty for being a little bit fluffier than I probably should have been. So when I got to the hospital, and everything was determined that I was allowed to go ahead with the donation, we were under the impression that all of those criteria that we were told about fell into place. My parents thought they had overheard a nurse inadvertently. She would have spoken out of turn, and certainly not on purpose, bring up that my donor liver may have been from the very accident that caused the traffic jam that I was stuck in trying to travel from Chicago to Indianapolis. That is irony. That's not coincidence. It's something that Alanis Morissette should probably learn. And we carried that idea around with us for months on end after the transplant. And it would be fair to say that I've probably got a few things I need to let go of that came immediately after the transplant that had nothing to do with the donor itself, but just the process of the donation, including and up to potential brain damage that I received. I suppose one might argue I've always been a little bit brain damaged, and that's okay, because it's probably true. I received the liver. We were under the impression that the story that we had heard about the accident victim in the traffic jam that I was stuck in traveling to Indianapolis was the correct one. And we didn't mind sharing it because we didn't know any other details other than this, very ironic, or I'll even say highly coincidental situation. Months went by and my recovery had gone very nicely. My donor, whomever this person may have been, and their liver just matched perfectly with my own anatomy. So I recovered physically at a rapid rate. I returned back to my teaching position in a little less than 3 months, even though I had been cleared to have the entire school year off. Emotionally, as we'll talk about more in the future, I was not prepared to go back. Not in the slightest. But physically, how wonderful that I received a gift, and that gift was able to adhere to my body type wonderfully. Boy, that man of the same body type and same blood type really did me a solid. Months went on, and February of 2016 rolled around, and I started to have this deep feeling that now was the time to reach out to my donor's family. Now seemed the right time to start communication. As you can imagine, as somebody who thrives on emotional relationships, for me not to know where my liver came from or to not have a relationship with that person's family would just be horrible. It would be horrible. And I could not continue sitting around imagining not being able to communicate with them effectively. Now, in most states, if you want to communicate with the donor's family, you may write a letter and you send it into that donor network of that state. So here in Indiana, we call that the Indiana Donor Network. I would type a letter or send a letter or email a letter or fax a letter in, and then they would make sure, since they are the only ones privy to the information, that the donor's family receives the communique. But the very day that I was going to sit down and begin communication with them, in fact, I had tried to write two or three different times that morning, and the words just didn't come. And if you know me well enough, you know the inability to put words together obviously means that it wasn't the right time. I've been blessed with the gift of gab, so to speak, and I can do it in print even better than with my mouth. So the fact that I could not start this letter, that I could not get the words out, because how do you actually say, I'm so sorry that your daughter died, or your son died, or your grandchild died, but man, thanks. I don't know how you do that. And I couldn't. I just felt like I was staring into the abyss, and the pencil in my hand just could not move. I went to the post office, the post box, I guess I should say, on my street where we receive our mail that afternoon. And my friend Bill, who himself happened to be an organ recipient of a kidney some years before, happened to be sitting with me. And I got into the mailbox, and here from the Indiana Donor Network was a letter addressed to me, hand addressed. Well, I knew it couldn't be a bill. I would seriously doubt I'd receive a bill for wanting to think about communicating with somebody. So I opened it with enthusiasm. There was a second sealed envelope, and on it it said, "To James." I looked at Bill. Bill looked at me. He said, "I think this is a letter from the family. You need to call Maggie." So I called my wife, and I sat nervously, hoping that she would answer so that I could share with her that I believe we received communication from our donor's family. Now, again, remember, all I'm thinking at this time is that it's going to somehow confirm what we believed to be true, that a man of roughly the same age, the same body type, the same blood type, may have passed away in this accident near West Lafayette. When my wife did answer the phone, I said, "If you have a few moments, I'd like to open this letter together." And it seemed right and fitting that Bill was actually there with us as well. And I opened the letter. And I read it, and it said, "Dear James, how honored we are that our daughter's liver was given to another teacher." And you know that sound that a record player makes when the needle is rubbed across the surface fast and you get this scratching sound? That's almost the sound that went off in my head, because two things went through my mind. A, how did they know what it was that I did for a living? And B, did they just actually say daughter? Reading it again, yes, they did say daughter. Later, I was able to confirm that all donor families are allowed to know the career path that the donee has taken. So although they did not know my last name, they did know that I was a teacher. Coincidence number one, because their daughter also taught. As the letter continues, it says, our daughter Ellen was a special education teacher. Ellen is my wife's middle name, Margaret Ellen. She goes by Maggie, but never goes by Ellen. Ellen, however, my donor, was a special education teacher. My wife is a special education teacher. Ellen, instead of taking the track, as many people do when receiving master's degrees in education, chose not to do administration. She chose to continue her path into understanding special needs in children. And she received her master's degree doing it. My wife did exactly the same thing. Ellen did not have children of her own. My wife had not either. She was very accepting of the three boys I had from my previous relationship, but we were not blessed with children of our own. As we continue to read down the letter, among the other things that are mentioned and will always remain private, the letter signs off with Love, Dick, and Pat. My wife's father's name is Richard, and his companion, now deceased, was named Pat. These alone would be coincidences that would make just about anybody's skin crawl or the hair on their neck to stand. But I shared this out on Facebook, and just the awe of these not so coincidental coincidences, right? I received a message from a friend that I had not talked to in, I would suspect, 25 years. He was elsewhere in the United States coaching, and he reached out and said, I know this person. I know this person. Are you sitting down? Of course, sitting is my favorite position, so I'm always sitting down. He said her last name is James. You could hear a pin drop. My wife and I immediately started crying. Because what else could you do? There is no other emotion that you could possibly express than tears. Were they tears of joy? Were they tears of anguish? I think for me, they were tears of, what do I do now? How is this possible? But it wasn't the last of the coincidences. You see, once it was revealed what her last name was, my wife remembered back to a conversation she had with a couple of friends who had visited while I was still in critical condition following my surgery with Ellen's liver. And one of the friends had remembered that there was a car accident near Huntington, Indiana. And it involved this person by the name of Ellen James. And wouldn't it be so coincidental, but yet beautiful, if James received her liver? And Maggie at the time explained, well, that is not really possible because, again, as we've established, sex and blood type, body size, etc. I did receive Ellen James's liver. Ellen was a teacher's assistant at one of the elementary schools that feeds into the only high school in Huntington County, the high school that I taught at. So of all of the people in this great big world, let's make it smaller. Of all of the people in this beautiful state of Indiana, 13 million people roughly, my liver, my new, beautiful, shiny liver, came from somebody who taught in the same school system I did, whose parents shared the same names as my wife's family, who had degrees in exactly the two areas, both bachelor's and master's, that my wife had her degrees in, who seemed to live a very parallel life to that of my wife in many ways. You see, we are not alone. We have never been alone. We never will be alone. But how wonderful it would be if we could just leave it there. But you see, over that last 5-year period of mine, I honestly could probably express as many failures as I have successes. There's likely a chance that I've had more failures, more false starts, more stops, more bad decisions than I did in any time leading up to my liver transplant. And in every time that situation comes, I apologize. Sure, I apologize to those I might have hurt. But more than anything, I apologize to Ellen, because I feel this overwhelming guilt to be as successful as I possibly can be in honoring her gift of life. It's not easy. These are those moments where, as I've mentioned before, the letting go and letting God take over, this is highly qualifiable, right? These are the moments where I should say, wow, okay, God, message sent and received. No, I think really what I did was I tried to hold on even more. Now I'm not just out to honor that gift. I'm out to impress her, the memory of her, the family members of hers that I may never meet. But if I did, I would want them to know that I did everything possible with her gift. I responded to the letter immediately and sent it right back. And in that letter, of course, my first question was, mind-blowingly, how did you know I was a teacher? But then I went on to express some of the same similarities that I just expressed to you about Ellen's own life and that of my wife, or me, frankly, and how somehow in this awful loss, we're designed to make sense of it. And we will. And I said at the end that I hoped for additional communication, that this was the beginning of a new relationship. And in my head, I could hear almost like this Hollywood type ending where we share these letters and then finally we meet and we hug. And, you know, the heartwarming videos you see online of heart donors, parents who then meet and listen to the heart of their daughter or son. Those are beautiful. Those are truly heartwarming. You really can't do that with a liver, but I was still determined to try. And so I hope that my letter landed with some authority, some purpose in wanting to do that. Her parents never received the letter. By no real fault of anyone in particular, my letter was kind of lost in the mailing system, in a protocol that happens sometimes, and it was lost for well over a year. Now, in my own head, I thought that I had somehow offended the family. The second thought was that they must not want to talk anymore. And you know, that's okay. Because maybe by this point, they had dealt with their grief and felt like that was a door they could close comfortably. Or maybe, like most of us, they would never be able to close that door and the pain was just too real. I was a reminder of that pain. So when I found out that the letter had been lost, there was, to put it mildly, frustration. And I begged and pleaded with the people at Indiana Donor Network to help me reach out to this family once again. And they were so willing to do that. They were so willing to help me. And so, in reaching back out to them, they finally did receive that letter that I had originally intended to send, but I had to rewrite it. Strangely, the emotion was even deeper because I now have had the time, a year plus beyond, to appreciate Ellen's gift even more. I now had new insight that I wanted to share, that I wanted them to know so desperately. I wanted them to know that I sometimes failed to live up to her gift, but that I tried every day to be better than the day before. We received another communication from Ellen's parents. It was revealed in that letter that they lived in Texas, and they wished me well and good health. And since that time, we have not communicated. That in and of itself feels like a little bit of an ending. But I should have perceived it more as a beginning, as a letting go, that I had been released to live my life the way that I wanted. That there was no obligation on the family's part. That there was no need to forcefully bring about this relationship. I have every day continued to believe that instead of it being a letting go, that it was a mission to fulfill Ellen's gift of life. And every July 24th, I find myself in a rather melancholy place where that survivor's guilt on all days, but particularly on this day of July 24th, seems to get the better of me. It's not a day of rebirth for me. It's a day of reflection. It's a day of remembering the loss that was Ellen James. It's a day of understanding that I have yet to fulfill my own mission here on Earth. And it's a day that I'll never forget. I could never forget. There are days that have come and gone over the last 5 years where I don't naturally think of Ellen. Boy, the guilt on those days is overwhelming. But in a way, it reconfirms the idea that her parents gave me in that second letter, that it's okay now, that peace has been found, and that I'm okay to live my life moving forward in whatever manner is deemed appropriate. I love this life. I feel as though Ellen has given me the ability to finally go out and achieve my purpose. But the guilt that comes with knowing that 5 years in, 5.5 years, soon to be 6 years in, I have still not achieved what my purpose is, not only frustrates me, but truly makes me sad. That is not to say I haven't had success. I have. But I will never feel worthy enough of her gift. That's the survivor's guilt that's hard to let go. And frankly, I think it's a healthy guilt for me to not let it go completely. Thank you, Ellen, for your gift of life. I so wish I could have met you. Hey friends, it's James. So we are putting a wrap on Liver Awareness Month, October of 2020. But I want to encourage you to keep this conversation happening. In April of every year, we celebrate Organ Donation Awareness Month. So in the time in between, why don't you take the time to consider being an organ donor? Go to donatelife.net or organdonor.gov. Better yet, if you know your own state's website for organ donation, take 30 to 60 seconds out of your day right now and register to be an organ donor. It really is that simple, and it really does save somebody else's life. Also, remember, please, if you are in the throes of addiction, if anxiety or depression are overwhelming you, or you have guilt over a situation that may not be in your control, please text 741-741, the crisis text line. They will work with you on whatever that issue is, and they will give you the tools necessary to overcome and be successful and to be the person that you deserve to be. 741-741, the crisis text line. Join me next time, won't you? Here on The Art of Letting Go. I'm James Steensma.